Our second case for this morning is Lambert against Perry Formworks, number 12-2502. We'll hear from Mr. Fanning.
May it please the Court. My name is Scott Fanning, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, McKinley Lambert, in his sexual and racial harassment, race discrimination, retaliation claim against his former employer, Perry Formworks System. The district court erred in granting summary judgment on all counts in favor of the defendant, Perry Formworks, for three reasons. One, a reasonable jury could have concluded that Perry had notice of the sexual harassment, both constructive notice and actual notice, and failed to take any action whatsoever.
But Mr. Lambert really didn't do too much, especially, I guess he makes one complaint to Mr. Santiago in 2005. Then nothing happens. Then he's a lead yard worker. He knows how to, well, of course, 2006, the plan comes into effect, a plan that he plainly knows how to use. How are we supposed to understand if yard workers have all these responsibilities that you say they do, why isn't he fully empowered to take his complaint up the chain?
Well, when the harassment started, and it's not disputed that it started in March of 2004.
Accepted for summary judgment purposes, of course.
Yes, he was a laborer.
He's a laborer then, so I'm looking at a different time period. So there's 2005 to 2006 when the policy comes into effect. He's a yard worker at that point. I guess Santiago is a lead, and there's just the one complaint, right?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Lambert complained on numerous occasions to Mr. Santiago while Mr. Santiago was a yard lead, as well as when Mr. Santiago was promoted to a yard manager.
But you're jumping ahead in time. I want this first year. So what does the record show about Mr. Lambert's complaints prior to the institution of the policy?
He would have only complained to Rodolfo Avila, who was a yard lead, and to Jesus Santiago as a yard lead.
No concrete evidence of what he said or how often he complained?
Well, no. He testified that he complained to them about the comments that Mr. Robledo was making, that they were advances, that they were, his term, gay acts, acts of homosexual advances, that he was offended by. There's a chain of command at the facility at the time where he reported as a laborer to the yard leads, who in turn reported to the yard manager. And that's his complaints to those yard leads, at the time he made those complaints, constitute notice under the Seventh Circuit standard in Bayer to the company. Because the yard leads were under a duty, were expected.
Well, where do you find that duty for the yard leads to pass it along to the yard manager or the logistics manager?
There's a testimony from Jesus Santiago, who was at one point a yard lead and then promoted to yard manager.
Could you be specific, because we didn't find in the record the cited pages from the deposition that you seem to be relying on.
It's in the brief on page 15. It's the record number 58-1, and it's page 63 of his deposition, lines 17 to 23.
It's page 63 that doesn't seem to be in the record.
It was submitted in response to the motion for reconsideration as well.
So
that's the first time you brought it to the district court's attention?
No, the citation was referenced in the motion for summary, in the response to the motion for summary judgment. That citation page was inadvertently left out of the submission. In the motion for reconsideration, we attached that page of the transcript as an exhibit.
I have a different question for you. Are you familiar with the case that's presently pending before the Supreme Court, Vance against Ball State?
No, Your Honor.
Vance against Ball State, which comes from this circuit, coincidentally, but that doesn't matter, deals with the question of what does it take to be a supervisor, how much authority, at what level do the more informal types of supervision that perhaps the yard leaders had trigger employer responsibilities or the law. And I'm just wondering, if you don't know the case, then you don't know it. But it may have some bearing, depending how the Supreme Court decides to resolve that issue.
Well, Your Honor, this is not about whether or not there's strict liability subject to an affirmative defense, or whether or not it's a coworker standard.
It's clearly a coworker. And so the only question is, does the company have notice, which is why I'm worried about where we find in the record what the responsibilities of these yard leaders are, whether that's fairly disputable. And I'm very concerned if you get up to 2006, once this policy is in place, with what appears to be Mr. Lambert's failure to use the policy as it's outlined in the face of evidence that he knows the phone number of this woman in Maryland who is the designated contact person, and she's certainly outside of his chain of supervisors, so there's no possibility reasonably of retaliation from her. So I have some significant issues, particularly with the post-2006 period.
Well, during the post-2006 period, he did complain to Jesus Santiago, who was a yard manager. And defendants don't dispute, for purposes of summary judgment, their national human resources manager admitted that an employee would be following their sexual harassment policy and be acting reasonably by bringing their complaint of sexual harassment to the attention of the yard manager.
But he, by this time, is a yard lead. He become, what, in 2007 he becomes a yard lead?
On that time, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, he's in a quasi-managerial position at that point. So doesn't he need to bring this to the attention of somebody who can do something about it?
Well, the issue isn't the reasonableness of his actions. It's whether the company had notice. And as, it doesn't matter how they got notice, but what's important is the notice they had. And they had constructive notice of it.
So constructive notice is a nice way of saying they didn't have notice. So I'm trying to see what glimmers there are in the record that it gets up to the point where somebody really says, you know, gee, you know, Mr. Robledo is behaving in a way that's inconsistent with our company's policies and we're going to do something about it.
Well, that's one. Actual notice is when he complained to Jesus Santiago in 2007 when he was a yard manager. The yard manager has the ability to suspend employees, and it was undisputed that they have a duty to stop the harassment once they become aware of it.
And in that, you're relying primarily, is it Osheroff, is that her name? The human,
if I got yes.
That you're relying primarily on her testimony and the responses to your additional statements and material facts that, in essence, yeah, it would be perfectly reasonable under that policy to go to the yard manager.
Okay. Mm-hmm. In any event, the constructive notice is important because it's not contested that the harassment happened over a three-year period, 2 to 3 times a week. And important is plaintiff's statement of fact 56.1, number 7, which defendants dispute in part, but don't contest that the sexual harassment had started in the yard and occurred in front of nearly every employee at the Calumet Park facility. They didn't dispute that that consisted of Hugo telling Mr. Lambert to suck his penis, to give him his ass, you have a beautiful ass, touching his buttocks twice, staring at Lambert's genitals, and spying on Lambert in the bathroom, and Mr. Robledo rubbing his body very close to Mr. Lambert.
Now, oddly enough, though, Mr. Lambert doesn't really, frankly, bring this to the attention of the company until he gets fired. And then he writes this letter with all sorts of grievances mentioned in the letter, including but not limited to the sexual harassment allegations.
Well, no, he did bring it to the attention of the company when he complained.
Not in the same way. I mean, you know, this letter, had he written the letter in 2005 when this misbehavior begins, we don't know. I mean, I don't know sitting here what the company would have done, but it certainly would have discharged all duties on Mr. Lambert's part to bring it to the attention of the company.
Yes, but there was no policy in place at the time telling him what to do. What he did was he followed the chain of command as a laborer and went to the yard leads. And one, the testimony I cited, Santiago said that yard leads were expected to bring any complaints or any observations of sexual harassment they observed to the yard manager who could stop it. Now, a reasonable juror could infer from those facts that Mr. Avila, Mr. Santiago's yard leads, did just that and did report Lambert's complaints onto the yard manager at the time. That's a reasonable inference that should be drawn in Mr. Lambert's favor.
If I could ask you about the racial hostile environment allegations. Mr. Wallace's reference to so-called donkeys, could you direct us to specific evidence indicating that this was a racial or ethnic reference that you would rely upon to dispute the defense's explanation? He was applying that to everybody.
Well, one is context. The laborers were primarily Hispanic and African American.
Do we have that somewhere in the record, that makeup?
The actual makeup, no. The defendants didn't cite the makeup either regarding the number of Hispanics. Mr. Lambert's claim that there was no Caucasians in his department. That was in the response to their statement of facts.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, it's also context. Mr. Wallace, who was making the context or making the comments about donkeys, was the same individual who had also referred to an African American, other than in Lambert's presence, as a gorilla. And so, taking those two combined, and the fact that majority of the laborers were minorities and not Caucasian, to me.
Okay, and then, if I recall correctly, when Lambert complained to Wallace about the donkey's comment, Wallace's response was something about, I've got stripes.
Yes, in response to being a supervisor, the reference was...
But Lambert's complaint was about racial and ethnic characterization of employees about as donkeys.
He didn't... What his complaint about the donkeys to Mr. Wallace was that he shouldn't be referring to employees as animals. He didn't specifically reference racial characteristics until he complained in April of 2007 about Serge Berger's use of the N-word, saying that he couldn't respect him.
So could you clarify how Mr. Lambert is using this evidence of racial harassment and discrimination? Is it to support the allegation that his firing, well, the fact that they took him to the test, was racially motivated, or is it a standalone claim of racial harassment or racial discrimination?
Well, there's a standalone claim of racial harassment with the N-word by one of the supervisors, Mr. Berger, the gorilla comment, as well as the donkey comments. In addition to that, Mr. Wallace was one of the decision makers who initiated the process to send Mr. Lambert to drug testing. So the evidence of his comments does go to show, one, that it could be racially motivated, and also that his complaints about Mr. Berger's comments on April 6th were a motivating factor, were one of the reasons why he was sent to drug testing. That was retaliation. So it supports a retaliation claim, racial harassment claim, and race discrimination claim. One of defendants' defenses to this constructive notice on the employer is that the conduct was just mere horseplay. And they acknowledge that Mr. Santiago observed some of the conduct. And their defense is that it was just males being juvenile. It wasn't sexually related. And that Mr. Santiago observed Mr. Lambert participating in it. But Mr. Lambert, one, denies that he participated in the conduct. And two, it's undisputed that he had complained to Santiago back in early 2005 about the sexual nature of these comments and that they were homosexual in nature.
Did Santiago recall those complaints in his depositions?
No, he denied them.
It's all right. I mean, I realize we have to take the facts as Mr. Lambert presents them at this point. If you want to save rebuttal time, this would be a good time to do it. You don't
I've
need
got
to.
One oh. quick question, though. I'd like to go back on this racial harassment. You said the defendants or your statement of material facts indicated that yard workers were all minority.
It was our response to their statement of facts.
Okay, maybe I'm looking at your additional facts. Okay. Can you direct me to a specific paragraph, Andy?
The record 49.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
If you have rebuttal, you can furnish that.
Okay. Yes,
reference.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Suzanne Decker, and I, along with my colleague Michael Howard, represent the defendant, Appalee Perry Formwork System. I am going to address the issues related to the notice on the sexual harassment claims in my 9 minutes. The remaining six will go to Mr. Howard to address the racial harassment and the retaliatory allegations regarding firing Mr. Lambert for being under the influence of alcohol at work.
So why isn't notice to a person with some supervisory authority, even if it's not hiring and firing on the yard, perfectly adequate under concepts of the way employers in the real world get to know things. Corporations don't know anything. I mean, it's people. And so you have to start somewhere. It seems to me a very natural place would be the person immediately superior to you.
When there's not a policy in place, which is when the complaints to the yard leads were made, when there's not a policy in place, this circuit has said there's a way of looking at it, which is that person a reasonable person to have complained to?
Right, and I'd have no idea why the yard lead isn't a reasonable person.
Day to day,
you go to work, you're not likely to shuffle around and find some phone number in Maryland if you're working around here. This was down in Calumet City, right? So I'm at a loss to know why that's not an adequate complaint.
Because the way that the facts come out in this case related to the actual duties that these yard leads had, the only duty that comes out from all of the testimony and the evidence is that they directed the daily workflow. And if you look at the cases that relate to this, such as Parkins and Parkins v. Civil Constructors and Bombacci, they focus on the fact that when you have individuals who complain to people who do not have true authority, then that is not reasonable in reporting it up. Yes.
Well, why isn't it reasonable, though, to expect those folks to pass it up the chain? I'm complaining about a coworker. I don't want to go to the guy who runs the whole facility. I go to my boss.
But there has to be some reasonable reason why you selected that person, that they have the power.
No, he doesn't have to have the
it.
Power. I just have to reasonably expect him to be able to pass it up the chain to somebody who can do something about it.
Correct. But
that's what Young against Bear tells us, right?
But the person that the individual went to in Young versus Bear was the supervisor's supervisor, who was the head of a department of 60 people. That's incredibly different than a yard lead who is nothing more than a working foreman.
No, why isn't that just an argument to be made to a jury?
Because at some point, their decision with respect to whether it would even a reasonable jury could even find that is, if we look at the factors coming out of Bear and out of Parkins related to the person needs to have the ability to hire or fire, or some authority to discipline.
Well, but maybe not. This is. I realize that in Vance the purpose is a somewhat different question, but there are many levels of authority, and as you say, the yard leads at least direct the daily workflow, but that's the first person. You know, what do you want me to be working on today? Go over there. Then there's the yard manager, then there's this logistics manager, and you're saying as a matter of law, this man had to go all the way up to at least, perhaps, I don't know how far you think he should have gone, to the yard manager, to the logistics manager, to the company headquarters, but why the first level of supervisor, even though not plenary authority, doesn't at least have the responsibility of bumping a serious complaint like this up the chain? This was not new law in 2005. It was very well established law. I just don't see why you see that this, as a matter of law, it's not anything more than just complaining to a coworker when you go to the yard lead.
It isn't more than complaining to a coworker. There's no evidence that they had some obligation or part of their job was to report up sex harassment. So if it wasn't part of the job, then you have to look at, do their other duties make it reasonable to believe that they have some type of authority? And in that,
job descriptions in the record, I can't remember.
There are not. And so we're left really with looking just at the testimony of all of the different yard employees. Santiago testified that yard leads had no ability to discipline, no input on performance evaluations. even Lambert, his testimony, the plaintiff in this case, his testimony was they really only guided employees on a daily basis. Now, he assumed they had authority to discipline, but he himself admitted that he never saw anybody engage in any discipline. And, in fact, Your Honor's brought up the appropriate point, which is when he became a yard lead and Robledo was still a regular worker, if he had all of this authority, why didn't he simply discipline Hugo Robledo?
Or kick it up the chain. I mean, that's what I'm still struggling with. Because as a yard lead, let's just stipulate that Santiago couldn't do anything when he was yard lead, but you know, presumably, what your chain of authority is, especially when you become part of it, even if you're at the bottom rung of the ladder.
But it's not as if they didn't have contact on a daily basis with people who had true authority.
How many people were in this yard?
Was, I apologize, Your Honor, I don't recall. But there was a yard manager that he had daily contact with that he testified about. There was a logistics manager who would have been sort of the overall operations manager who he saw discipline employees and who he had contact with. There was a regional manager. And all of these cases, Parkins and even Bear, note that if there would have been there's someone else that would have been more reasonable that who had the authority but you decided not to, then that's input on how reasonable it is.
No, I'm having trouble, frankly, understanding how all of that is can be decided as a matter of law, particularly given the way most hierarchical organizations tend to discourage going outside the chain of command or jumping over your immediate supervisor. I'd like to ask you, though, we've got Mr. Lambert's affidavit testifying about having made complaints to Santiago when he was a yard manager. We've got Osheroff saying, yep, complaining to a yard manager is good enough. Could you direct me to the specific deposition testimony that you think closed the door to that testimony in the affidavit?
Yes, and that is in the record 34-4 at page 154 of Mr. Lambert's deposition testimony. And it's spelled out actually in our brief on this topic on page 24.
What I never saw there is the question, did you talk to Santiago any other time about this? I never saw the door closed.
Except that the question was presented, did you complain in 2005? Did you complain in 2006? And he had no recollection. Yet by the time this affidavit comes into play, it's I was complaining multiple times throughout this entire period of time. And it includes certainly part of the testimony that he testified to here and then adds a little bit more on top that's contradictory.
What's the contradiction?
The contradiction is that
Show me the Q&A.
Was it in 05 or in 06? I couldn't tell you.
He doesn't say which year it was.
And he doesn't indicate that it was on more than one occasion.
Was he asked?
I believe that the question covers that the response, if it had been on multiple occasions, the response would have come at that point in time.
What's the question?
The question relates to his discussions with Jesus Santiago. The question is, when did you talk to Jesus? I can't get a special date on it. I don't recall the date. It could have been in some months. Goes on, well, could it have been in 05 or 06? I couldn't tell you.
And
questions are open-ended enough.
Come on. Every witness is trained to answer the question that's asked. And if you don't close the door, it's not closed.
But on that conflict that we see created through this affidavit that the plaintiff filed only after the need for additional testimony and on opposing summary judgment, his plaintiff's counsel could have clarified that testimony.
He has no obligation to do that. He does not have to ask him about anything that you didn't ask about, right?
But in filing the affidavit, the case law on that point indicates that it should have been more specific if it was going to contradict the testimony.
If it contradicts, if you simply wish you had asked, if the question was not as clear as you wish it had been in hindsight, there's no contradiction.
All right. I see my time is up. Do you want to hear anything on the constructive discharge piece?
No. We will look at your brief for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm here to discuss Mr. Lambert's hostile work environment claim and his claim of retaliation and race discrimination. Earlier, we were discussing the use of the term donkey and whether or not that was racially motivated or whether it was simply a term that's used in Scotland where Mr. Wallace was from. And indeed, if you look at Mr. Lambert's responses to our requests, we have an allegation that says, during the time that Wallace referred to general laborers as donkeys, there were Caucasian, African American, and Hispanic individuals employed as general laborers. That testimony comes from Mr. Santiago, who was the yard manager at that facility. In response, they object and state that it's vague and irrelevant and doesn't specify in which department there were white laborers.
What paragraph is that?
That's paragraph 51 in the response, page 20 of 29.
Your fact 51?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And it's not disputed. It says, for example, at the time there were no white employees in plaintiff's department. No citation of the record. No evidence whatsoever of that fact. And there's no allegation that he only used the term donkey for specific departments. Mr. Wallace has to, in the testimony, it came out that Mr. Wallace would say, if there was a tough job that needed to be done, go get a couple of donkeys to help you. Is it polite? No. But is it based on race? No. Nowhere in the record is there any place is this tied to any type of racial connotation. You also need to consider that the totality of the circumstances need to be evaluated when looking at a hostile work environment claim. So in this case, this term about donkey was used 5 times in 3 years. It has no context, there's no evidence that has anything to do with race. That leaves us with 2 comments in 3 years. One, Mr. Wallace referred to one of Mr. Lambert's co-workers, as a big old gorilla. And in another comment, another employee, a coworker who was a supervisor, but not Mr. Lambert's supervisor, no authority over him whatsoever.
But part of management.
He was a supervisor of what's called the ACS division, which is in a separate portion of the facility.
He's part of management.
If you're
a yard donkey, he's part of management, right?
He was not a yard worker. He did have people that reported to him.
Lambert was the yard donkey at that point, right?
Yard donkey?
Mr. Wallace's term?
Mr. Wallace would refer to laborers as donkeys, yes.
And that was Lambert.
He was a laborer at
one
point.
And when Berger called him a nigger,
mm-hmm.
Berger's part of management, right?
He was not his manager, but he was a supervisor. He was a manager. He was a
Thank
supervisor.
You.
Now, that's 7 total comments in 3 years. Under the precedent of this circuit, that simply isn't enough.
The precedent of this circuit takes into account both the severity of what went on as well as the frequency. And we've noted on more than one occasion that when the word nigger is used, that is an incredibly powerful and negative thing to say to somebody. It's completely unacceptable.
Completely unacceptable.
And so even though, just once, I don't know, I'm not familiar with the one free bite rule on that.
Well, there are 2 cases I can point your attention to. Peters, 307 F3D 535. That case, motion for summary judgment was granted even though the N-word was used. And there were more than
By
eight.
Who?
I don't know offhand, Your Honor.
Co-workers or management?
I don't know, Your Honor. I apologize. But even if it was a manager, still, it wasn't his manager. This person didn't have any authority over him. So,
but we're talking about a hostile environment, and when somebody in a position of authority, even if it's not your boss, is using language like that, it certainly poisons the workplace for the individual who's targeted by it.
Well, Your Honor, it may, but you also have to look, again, to tally the circumstances involved, whether or not it was severe, whether or not it affected his ability to perform his job. Mr. Lambert had no attendance problems. He received promotions. He received raises. People made sure that Mr. Santiago made sure that people were following his directions in the yard. He testified he wasn't looking for another job. So I agree. It's unacceptable that was said. But Title VII looks at whether or not the behavior rises to the level that makes it actionable. So there are many improper things that can happen in the workplace that simply don't get to the level where you can bring a claim for them. It doesn't make them right, but it doesn't make them actionable.
So why not allow the jury to evaluate the totality of those circumstances where you've got management referring to the yard donkey as a nigger?
Your Honor, I think that if that were the case...
To his face.
If that were the case, you would be flooded. And simply Title VII isn't intended to remedy one-off comments or a few comments over a three-year period. In this circuit, it's supposed to remedy a hellish work environment.
No, we have actually, following Harris against Forklift, said that is an overstatement and it does not have to be hellish. Indeed, that was the whole point of the Supreme Court's holding in Harris. So it certainly has to affect the terms and conditions of one's job. And again, it's severity or pervasiveness. It's not in the conjunctive. But and certainly there are cases where maybe one remark over a three-year period, depending on what it is, might not be enough to satisfy either the severity or pervasiveness test. Certainly wouldn't be pervasive. So, no, it doesn't have to be hellish. We've addressed that.
I understand, Your Honor, but I would still submit that five comments about Donkey and two others, so you have seven comments, six of which were not directed at Mr. Lambert, secondhand harassment, said to someone else. Mr. Lambert was never called a donkey directly to his face. Mr. Lambert was not called a gorilla. He overheard these things. These were not statements directed at him, and this circuit has recognized that secondhand harassment does not go as far as direct harassment to create a hostile work environment infraction.
Okay. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Fanning?
Just a couple points.
Judge Hamilton, defense counsel pointed to you to the record I was referring to, which would be paragraph 51 of defendant's.
So what have you got by way of evidence?
There's no direct evidence in the record regarding the racial makeup. Okay, turning to the issue of the standard of bear, which they cited to. According to that, the person doesn't have to have the authority to end the harassment. Seventh Circuit recognized that the employer has noticed if it comes to the attention of someone who could reasonably be expected to forward complaints up the ladder, and that they had the ladder, and it was more than reasonably expected. They were required to, yard leads, to pass the complaints up the chain of command.
Well, you don't, but the evidence is awfully thin on the requirement. Would it have been a reasonable thing to do? Perhaps. I don't know, but and maybe we'll need to look at that. But I just don't see where the concrete evidence is that says, I knew that one of my responsibilities as a yard lead was to pass generalized complaints about the workplace along to the yard manager. Who says that? We know we don't have a job description, so who says that?
Jesus Santiago said that. It would be expected of him to report any sexual harassment he observed to the yard manager.
But would a co-employee have said the same thing?
Santiago was asked that, and he said he wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And even if there was no complaints, they were on constructive notice. It was so frequent and pervasive that it can
be
inferred.
Apparently this workplace was a rough one, I guess I'll just say. So what gives me some pause about your constructive notice just from looking around is the subjective reactions of people and the ability or inability to hear the content of what was being said. People can say some pretty crude things in joking ways and in other horseplay sorts of ways. And so I don't know. I think that's not as strong a point as the actual notice.
It has to be looked at in context with Lambert's earlier complaints to Mr. Santiago, who did become yard manager during this time period.
Mm-hmm.
That gives him a reason to believe that this open conduct was offensive and sexually based to Mr. Lambert.
Okay. Well, I think that will do it. And thanks to you and thanks to counsel. We will take the case under advisement.